Privilege to host, to welcome, to, I'm an Al-Anon, hover a little over our speaker and fall in love with her. I picked her up yesterday from the airport and we went actually to my neighborhood to go get a bite to eat. She wanted to walk a little and she came into my home. And when we were leaving, she said, I really feel like I've gotten to know a person when I come into their home. So I would like for us to warmly welcome to our home, Rhonda from Wichita Falls, Texas.
Don't touch it. Yeah, okay. I follow direction pretty good. My name's Rhonda. I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. I'm going to fess up. I don't have a home group. My home group died of COVID. And we tried to start it and just didn't go. So I got something I need to either try to start that again or find a home group. So now that I've done my fifth step, I want to thank Stacy and Baron. Great. They kind of took care of me last night. And Stacy for following up. I was invited to speak here in 2020. They called me in 2019. And then they canceled. And then I was in 2021 and they canceled. And here I am. So I know without a doubt this is a divine appointment. And you know, talking to Stacy and stuff and emailing back and forth, and are you going to touch the mic? How come you get to and I don't? That's Mike. So, then I got assigned a host, and we met for the first time on Zoom virtually and just clicked. And it's been great. We traded phone numbers. We've texted back and forth, and she picked me up at the airport, and she has hovered and doted. And I tell you, now I know why you alcoholics like to have an Al-Anon. I have my own Al-Anon. And it was fabulous, and but you know that the best part of that is today, as this program has afforded me, is I could accept that. I could accept her doing that, and really kind of needed it. You know, God knows what I need long before I do. Just really needed it to actually let somebody take care of me. You know, so one other thing, Mike, the taper, CD, or thumbnailer now, go see him. That is an important ministry. I want to tell you how important it is. Because I had someone put two tapes in my hands early on. One of them was an AA speaker, one of them was an Al-Anon speaker. And I can't remember who the AA speaker was, but the Al-Anon speaker was Vinoy. And those two tapes, I would walk in my backyard with my little headphones and my little tape player that would connect to them. If y'all don't know what a tape player is, you can Google University it. It'll show you exactly what it was, little cassette tapes. And, man, I listened to them over and over and over again. And that AA speaker said, and I just said it today, the first quote I picked up was, nobody's going to do it for you, and nobody did it to you. And I still remember that today. So, I'm not from Texas. I've lived in Texas a long time. But I'm from Marlow, Oklahoma. And it's a little town just north of Duncan, Oklahoma, south of Oklahoma City. But that was where I was born and raised. And my parents were not alcoholic, but they were Southern Baptist. And I was a drug Baptist. They drugged me to that Baptist church every time the doors were open. My daddy was a deacon. My mama taught Sunday school. And I had an older brother and a younger brother, and most of my life was around that church. Went to church camp, you know, did sunbeams and, I don't know, all those little things that we're involved in, Bible school and everything. And I had a great childhood. Man, I was full of it. I had an older brother and a younger brother, and I was going to do everything they did. You know, I could climb a tree, I could bait a hook, catch the fish, clean it myself. You know, I rode bikes with them, I did everything, and we ran around barefoot. You know, we drank out of the water hose. I don't know how we survived, but, you know, we ride our bicycles to the swimming pool and swim all day and come home burnt little crispy critters and, you know, all the stuff that today we just don't do, but it was great. We played kick the can and hide and seek, and there were no fences. And so, I mean, we had the whole neighborhood. And my dad could whistle really, really loud. And he would go out on the front porch and whistle, and we knew we were supposed to come home. And I could hear it two blocks away. Two blocks away, I could hear that whistle. Man, we would head home quick. And I remember my last happy, safe memory was I was laying in the backyard on my back. Always loved outside. And I was laying on my back looking up at the stars, and I was listening to my little whatever transistor radio. You can look that up too. And Petula Clark was on there, and she was singing, "My love is greater than the greatest ocean, wider than the sea," and just could feel God's love. Because, you know, I was raised with a hellfire and damnation God, strike you with lightning. And I believed that, but there was some love there, and I thought, it's the big, vast universe. I don't really remember a whole lot of the rest of kind of my childhood, because at 11 years old, I had a family member that sexually abused me. And what happens with that is, for me, is I completely shut down. I learned how to disassociate. I focused on everyone's behavior so I would do the right thing at the right time so that I could maybe control that wouldn't happen again. I blamed my parents. They were supposed to protect me. I never told anybody. Went on for a couple of years, and it stopped. And I went on with my life. And but the effects of that are long-terming. I still deal with it today. There's trauma triggers I still deal with. You know, anytime I'm threatened, man, I'm, you know, it's there. So I became very sexually promiscuous. What did you call it, Georgia? A bit of a hoe. Anyway, and at age 16, I found myself pregnant. And how are you going to tell your Southern Baptist parents that you're pregnant at 16? And they kind of figured it out and confronted me. And I fessed up. And I can remember my dad cried. You know? I knew this was going to be emotional talk. Anyway, and I'm not a crier, but I'll probably cry, and it's okay. I decided, because the neighbor's daughter next door had got pregnant and had a baby out of wedlock, and they called that child a bastard. It was labeled. And in Marlowe, you know, in small town, and this is back in the early 60s, that's the way it was, and I didn't want that for my child. And so I decided to go to a home for unwed mothers, and I gave that child up for adoption. So she was born in 1970 in December, a little girl. I got to hold her for 30 minutes, and they took her away. And I went home the day before Christmas, I guess, you know, Christmas Eve. I went home. And the emptiness in the hole. And you see, I'm from the nice family. We don't talk about stuff. You're going to be nice. And so we didn't talk about it ever again. It was done. And I can remember crying myself to sleep at night with this hole for that child. I didn't know how to grieve, but I knew how to shut it down, and that's exactly what I did. And I went on, and I graduated high school. I started, I never really had any close girlfriends. I did, I had a grade school friend, and, you know, like up until like the fifth grade, and then I didn't, because things changed. I never had another girlfriend, like a bestie. I had friends, so I had this friend that I hung out with, and her brother was going to college in Chickasha, and she told me one day, she said, "My brother's going to ask you out." I said, "Okay." So, you know, I just wasn't doing that much anymore because it caused that, and I didn't want to do that, and so I had kind of quit hoeing around. And so he asked me out, and we went to Chickasha, and we went to a college dance, and it was all pretty calm, and I loved to dance, but he didn't like to dance, and so we didn't dance, and it was kind of a strange date. Well, he asked me out again, and when someone of my type, that's my friend, didn't want to hurt her, so I said yes. Second date, we double dated with some friends. Now, he had a 1966 cobalt blue GTO. And we loaded up. Guess what? My son has that today. Same that vehicle. Anyway, we loaded up in that GTO. They had a cooler of beer, and they drove real fast, and they drank that beer, and we got married in October. We started our life together, and so I have permission to use his name. I'm going to. Richard was joined the Air Force, and, you know, joined the Air Force, see the world, and we went to Little Rock Air Force Base. We got married, you know, and that's where we were at, is Little Rock. And then we were there for several years, you know. Well, I thought that marriage was going to be where, like, my mom and dad. My dad would come home from work. My mom's cooking supper. He'd come in and nuzzle her neck, maybe pat her on the bottom. And he'd help her do the dishes. And, you know, that was their life. Oh, no, in my mind. You know, I would come home and I would cook supper and everything, and he wouldn't come home. Now they had a little. He was in Titan II missiles, and they had a little thing out on the flight line, and they'd get what do you call it? The beer, and they'd get drunk. He'd come home drunk late at night, you know, and I would ask him where he's been. Now that's the second dumbest question you can ask an alcoholic. The first one is, have you been drinking? I know he'd been drinking, but I mean, you know, he would just do that. He wouldn't come home. When he did, he would be drunk. And I don't know anything about alcoholism, and he decided that he would try to curtail his drinking, and he would, if he did, all he had was a dollar, then he wouldn't go by the club, and he wouldn't get drunk, and, you know, well, he decided to do that one night. He got drunk on a dollar. You know, he had a guy that locked his keys in the car, and he needed to go, you know, so he took him to get his keys and came back, and the guy bought him, you know, whatever, until. But he drank till the booze was gone, the bar was closed, the money ran out, you know, once he started. And then he would have these long periods, and then he would get torqued off. That's what we called it, torqued off. And that was pretty much our life. And then in 1970, I'm trying to do a time sequence because I have people say they get mixed up in my story because I can be all over the place. But 70... 4, 5, we moved to Wichita Falls. Joined the Air Force, see the world. We're 73 miles from our hometown. And there was a school there that was an instructor for Titan IIs, and he's still in the Air Force. And I was a hairdresser. My grandmother, my mother's mother, was a hairdresser. She had this little, I call it the Steel Magnolia Salon, in the back of her house. And I learned to shampoo hair at 13. I used to think that was because she wanted to help me because I wanted to go to cosmetology school. But no, she just wanted me to wash her hair. And she taught me really good how to shampoo hair. If you ever been to a hairdresser, and they just kind of, you know, she taught me to scrub that head. But so I wanted to always be a beauty operator. You know, that's what they were called back in Civil War days. So anyway, she had a big influence on me. And because I had shut out my parents, this was my one person that loved me unconditionally. She was the one person that asked me about that child and about the feelings with associated to that. The only person in my life. And, you know, that, so I, when I went to Arkansas, I got my license there and not in Arkansas, yeah, and then I had worked long enough that I could get my license in Texas. And I went to this one salon, and I went to work there, and it was kind of the up-and-going salon in Wichita Falls. And about 2 months after I worked there, this girl quit, and I had this booming business. I mean, I was busy. I was making good money, and when he didn't go home, I went to the mall. Where's Randy? I bought shoes. He was talking about shoes, you know, because, you know, you could buy a new pair of shoes and it will change the way I feel. I could put them on and it would be warm and it would go down and boom. And I was like, ooh, I got some hot shoes here. And, but you know, it's just like the alcohol for me. I mean, for the alcoholic. After I wore them a little bit, the new wore off. Not quite as good, you know. Digging around in my 50 pairs of shoes and couldn't find the right ones. You know, a girl can do anything with the right pair of shoes. And so that was my thing. It was all about how I looked. You know, because if everything out here was okay, I might be okay in here. Might's the big word. I might be okay. And I worked there, and we just rocked along, and we decided to have my first son, and there was a realtor that lived next door, knew that I was in the salon business. There was a salon for sale, and there was a house behind it, and so Richard thought that was a really good thing. So we bought this little strip of property, the salon in the front, and we started our business. They had to completely redo the salon, and we lived in the house and behind. And so I was doing hair, and we were doing really well. And then the property next to it came up. It was a rental property. We bought that. So we owned this one-fourth of a block in Wichita Falls. And then I had my second son in 1980. My first son was born in 77. They're 6 years apart. It's real funny. There's 6 years between my daughter and my son, my first son, and then 6 years between my two sons. And we, you know, we were doing the deal. We had the life. We had the big house. We bought the big house. He had since got out of the Air Force. He was civil service, moving on up. And, I was a business owner. We moved the salon. We put in a 10-chair salon with a nail tech. And it was this big booming salon. And it looked like from the outside that everything was great. It looked like that. But on the inside of that house was the turmoil. And, you know, he would do the same thing. He would not come home. And I had these two little boys. And, we would get into an argument. And he would get mad. And he would throw whatever was near and make a hole in the wall. And I would end up apologizing and cover the hole with a picture. You know, my self-respect at any price. Any price to keep peace. I hated conflict because I felt threatened when conflict happened. And he knew it. He controlled me I allowed him to control me with his anger. And he was a very angry man, and I never knew what was setting him off. So we walked on eggshells. I would wait till he come home. I would, you know, look at his demeanor, and I would try to adjust the situation to whatever, just so he wouldn't get set off. and did this for years. We did one geographical. If you're going to do one, better do it up good. So he comes home one day and he said, I'm going to put my name in the hat for this job in Saudi Arabia. I said, well, that's great. You know, you can go. I'm not going. I didn't know about don't make threats you don't intend to carry out. And then we went to Saudi Arabia. But let me back up just a little bit. In 1988, we had this rental property, and one of our largest areas was for rent. And I was working away at the salon, and these two guys come in one day. And they say, we want to rent your space next door. And I said, okay. What do y'all want to put in there? And he said, well, we want to put an AA club in there. And I said, okay, can you tell me a little bit about AA? You know, it's just, well, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. We're recovering alcoholics. They told me about it. I said, we're going to have to talk to my husband. And so we rented our space to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was called Southtown. And they were a club. And let me tell you, they were an active club. There was a bunch of members. They had a big Al-Anon group. They had an Alateen group. They did cookouts in the back of the building where we had a little area that was fenced. And people coming and going. And, you know, were those Alkies next door? And that's what we talked about in the shop was the Alkies next door. And they... You know, I had the idea that an alcoholic was the bum on the corner that could not work and that drank every day with the brown bag. That was my idea of an alcoholic. You know, and I would look out the blinds in the salon at the people coming and going at that meeting at noon. Lawyers, people I knew in town, lawyers, doctors of all walks of life. All walks of life, you know. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would go over there, and because, you know, I had tried to get my little kids to be little drug Baptist, you know, I started going back to church because I wanted to earn God's favor. Because of all of that hoeing around, I was going to go to hell. You know, all of that stuff I did in my past. And I tried to measure up. So going to church and everything. And I went in there, and they had God stuff on the wall. And I was pretty impressed. And there's a church across the street. And then they had parking because we didn't have a lot of parking. So I went and talked to the pastor about them parking there, you know. And, oh, he told me that he thought it was great. Alcoholics Anonymous was great and all this stuff. And, yes, they could park in the church's parking lot. And so, you know, that was in 88. And then in 1990, I had a booth open in my shop, and I have permission to use her name, too. She says, don't call me that lady from AA. So I had an interview one day, and she came in, and we're sitting on the couch. It was on a Monday, and the shop was closed. And she said, before we even start, I want to tell you, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been looking in your window wanting to work here for a long time. I have 5 years of sobriety. Do we still have an interview? And I said, we sure do. Because, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was the best tenant we'd ever had. They kept up stuff. They paid their rent on time. You know, if there was a problem, they let us know. Most of it they fixed themselves, you know. So Nancy came to work in my shop. And all these people in recovery came with her. Her clientele. They were the laughingest, huggingest bunch of people I'd ever seen. I didn't know what to do with y'all. I mean, it was like, whoa. Because, you know, I'm still shut down. You know, I don't want to feel the hurt, so I shut down everything. And I remember Nancy came in one day, and she came buzzing by, and she stopped and kind of gave me a little half hug and said, I love you. And, you know, all I could say was, ditto. I was not used to that, you know, So I got a lot of influence about AA. So... From that, I went to my first, it was an NA meeting, birthday night, where she celebrated. You know, she got 6 years. And I went to this, it was a dance, and I was like, I was a little bit afraid. These were addicts. Anyway, but and I went to every one of her birthday nights, you know, every time she celebrated, because we became besties. And I don't remember when it was. She came to work for me in 1990, but we went to the Sam's to get something. We became best friends, of course. You know, that's, I'm attracted to that, those people. But we're sitting in the parking lot at Sam's, and I told her about the sexual abuse. It was the first person that I ever told, ever. And I'm 30-something years old. Because, you know, Nancy could share the smutty details of her life and all that stuff that she did. And I felt free enough or open enough to tell somebody that that had happened to me. You know, and that's when, you know, I think my recovery began. So back to going to Saudi Arabia. We went to Saudi Arabia in 1991 in July. We moved over there. And he was in charge of training for the Royal Saudi Air Force. And we lived on a compound. And it was like I was June Cleaver again, you know. My kids rode a bus to school. They went to an international school. And there was a little salon on this compound. And I set up business in the salon. Well, if you want to be famous, you go to Saudi Arabia as a hairdresser because there's not any. And if they are, they're not. I mean, I was a licensed American hairdresser. They went nuts. I went to a coffee, I had a tea at the embassy in Saudi Arabia. You know, and from a little girl from rural Oklahoma, I'd never flown. I'd never hardly been out of Oklahoma, Texas, Missouri area, Arkansas. And I'm in Saudi Arabia, you know. And the favorite pastime to do in Saudi Arabia is shopping. So I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. But I went to this coffee, and I had on my name tag, and these people were coming up to me. You're the American hairdresser. You're the American hairdresser. You're on the, you know, rock compound. And it was crazy. I was famous overnight. And I loved it. And we were there 2 weeks. And he went TDY, which was mean he left. He had to come back to the States for 2 weeks. And he came back and was there a week, and we came back to the States for 2 weeks. I mean, it was like, it was great. Now in Saudi Arabia, you can't have alcohol. And, it was right at the end of Desert Storm. So they had tea rations, they called them. So they opened up tea rations, and we had to order alcohol at one time a month. And he ordered all this alcohol. Now, you know, he would come home and he would drink scotch. And I didn't monitor that. I was too busy trying to keep everything looking good. And we had more alcohol in our house when we lived in Saudi Arabia than we did anywhere else. And you had to keep everything controlled and turn everything back in. And, you know, and we were there about a year. But, I mean, we shopped. We could drive. Everybody said, wasn't it terrible? I said, no. Somebody drives you to where you're going to go shopping. You go shopping. They pick you up. They drive you back, and they carry your goodies in the house. How hard is that? I mean, you know, I had a houseboy. He cleaned my whole house. He squeegeed my marble porch. I had a marble patio. And two bidets. I mean, it was like, yeah, it was really rough. And he would even walk my dog for like $14 a week. That's what he made, you know. So we were there about a year, started having trouble with my older son. He was 14. My younger son was 8. And there was an incident that happened that, it's too long a story, I'm not going to go into it, but we ended up having to get out of the kingdom. And we flew out, we flew to Spain from Dahran. We had to go to Dahran, and we flew out of there to Spain, and we got on a a DC-5. I don't know if you know what a DC-5 is, but it's the biggest plane, and you could drive a tank up in it. And we, you know, you ride up in the top part, and the seats are all backwards. And my younger son wanted to know, man, they really must be a good pilot if they can fly this plane backwards. That's what I remember about that. But I was really, I mean, we came back to the States, and talk about shell shock. I mean, there was so many things that there was no crime. You could leave your purse in a shop. I mean, the shopkeeper, you come in, and, oh, good price for you, madam, and he would leave and go get you cappuccino and bring it back in a store because nothing would be stolen. You know, and the crime and the stuff that was here, and that stuff was really, really, you know, was an eye-opener because I hadn't been had to deal with that. But we had rented our house out. We had a 6 months, no, it was a year lease, and it hadn't been quite a year, so the people were still in my house, and I didn't have a place to live, and Nancy said, why don't you and the boys, because he had to go back, and we decided to stay. You and the boys come live with me. So, you know, it was going to be like for a month. So I went and lived with Nancy, you know, and she would, those people would call her on the phone, you know, those people. And she would say, have you prayed? What's your part? Because I'm only hearing half of this. And, well, we need to do a four step, you know. And I started hearing this stuff. So I asked her, what is that? What is a four step? So she showed me, you know, what is a fifth step? She showed me. So before I ever got to Al-Anon, I knew what that stuff was. I knew what a fourth step, fifth step was. You know, to keep coming back, all of that. And I'd never, you know, I wasn't in recovery. And I liked what you said at the end of your talk. Alcoholism affects all of these people, but so does recovery. One person in recovery can change the dynamics of a whole system. One person. And that's, you know, that's what happened to me, is that I was already changing. So he's still drinking, and we were having a lot of marriage problems because I outgrew that little box when we came back from overseas, and we were fighting and fighting. We got back in our house. You know, I went on strike. I didn't put any pictures on the walls. I didn't decorate. Stuff was boxed up. I was going to clean it out. I was, you know, I'm done. I was pretty done. And he was working. He was working on a committee where they were blending all the training for the armed services there for Wichita Falls. And he was gone, went off to the Pentagon. And it's like, oh, well. And he drank more. And we decided to go to a marriage counselor, and he picked one out, and we started. But before this, I remember I got up one day, and I'm working out because I got to look good, and I started crying. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. I cannot do this anymore. And I called Nancy, and she said, why don't you go see someone? You can go to First Step, which was a place for battered women, and you can see this lady. I do her hair. And so I called over there, and believe it or not, she got me in that day, and I went over there, and I talked to her, and she told me, she said, do you not think you live in domestic violence? And I said, no, he doesn't hit me. She said, but you just described he took a motorcycle helmet and threw it at the wall in the garage several times and made big holes. Is that not domestic violence? Is that not violence? You told me you ripped the screen doors off the house. Is that not violent? You know, and she yanked off my denial blanket just a little bit. And then he decided we needed to go to marriage counseling so they could fix me. And we went. And the second time we were there, this counselor said, can you go 30 days without drinking? And he said, of course I can. And he said, well, if you can't, I'm going to stop treating you for a marriage problem and start treating you for an alcohol problem. And that was the first time the little Al-Anon meter went off or whatever it is. I started monitoring his drinking. He did not go 30 days. And and it was shortly after this. It was noon. He came home one day. He had that look in his eye. And it was like, I think he's been drinking. And he got the Bible out. And he opened up and he said, this says in here you're supposed to obey me. And, of course, I told him, yeah, you're supposed to love me like, you know, lay down your life for me, Jesus, whatever it says. And so I went in there to finish the laundry, and he came at me and trapped me with my back against the dryer, and the dryer door was over my knees, and he had me backwards, and he was choking me. And one of the things I remember that counselor told me, he said, he's a man, he won't ever hit you, but he might kill you. And, you know, I saw my life flash before my eyes. What is the joke? You know, when Al-Anon faces death, somebody else's life flashes before their eyes. But my older son was 18. He was home that day, and he heard all the commotion, and he came out, and he pulled his dad off of me. And I got free of that, and I called the police. And I got off the phone with the police, and in the laundry area, there was the back door to the garage. And Richard's out in the garage hobbling around saying he broke my leg. And my son's got this cut here. And there's glass and liquid everywhere. And I realized that it's a scotch bottle had been thrown and broken. And so I go back and I call and I say, we need an ambulance now. And so it was Monday about 1 o'clock and the cop car pulls up, and I'm looking out the blinds. As Benoit says, these aren't crow's feet, they're Venetian blind marks. And this cop car pulls up, and this little bitty cop gets out. She gets out of the cop car. She's about my size, probably weighed 100 pounds, soaking wet. I thought, this is great. I have a monster out there in the garage, and they send this female police officer. And then the next cop car pulls up and the big old guy gets out. And I'm thinking, back up, you know. So I go out there in the garage and he is out in the driveway trying to do something with the GTO and he couldn't drive it because, you know, he needed the foot that was broke to drive it. And it's the cop's out there trying to deal with him. She's dealing with him. And I start trying to tell her because, you know, she needs to know my part. I need to tell her. And so and every time I did, he would start yelling at me and hissing and spitting at me. And she said, ma'am, I need you to back up in the garage. And I watched it kind of like slow motion, you know. He pushes her in the chest, calls her a bitch, and she takes out that little thing, wraps it around his neck. She had him on the ground like that. And I'm in the garage going, you go, girl, I want to know how to do that. That was impressive. Anyway, so they handcuffed him. They stuffed him in the ambulance and took him off. And so I go in the house and I call a friend. We're going out tonight. We're going to celebrate. He's in jail and I am free of that crap and we're going out. Today, it saddens me. That saddens me. Because we'd been married 23 years, we had two kids and all this life together. That's how hard-hearted I had become. My hard-heartedness. You know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And I was so indifferent. Alcoholism did that. Not Richard, alcoholism. So I wouldn't talk to him, you know, call, and I wouldn't even answer the phone. He was trying to get somebody to get him out of jail. And finally, the captain that he worked for called and said, Richard didn't come back from lunch. And I said, nope, he's in jail. And so that captain went down to the jailhouse, bailed him out. They came over. We had a motor home. They got it, and they took the motor home out to where he lived. He kind of lived outside of Wichita Falls. And, man, I was done. I'm going to divorce him. I am done. Sick of this. And the next day, he kept trying to call me, and I wouldn't talk to him. And, he talked to Nancy, and Nancy told him he probably needed to go to Red River Hospital because he was depressed. And so he checked in there for depression on Tuesday night, and Wednesday they moved him to the floor where they treat him for alcoholism. And so he calls me at the shop Wednesday, and because I couldn't monitor the phone or whatever, I talked to him, and I answered the phone, and he said, they moved me. I'm on the floor where they treat for alcoholism. And he said, Rhonda, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I know, and I hung up the phone. That's detachment. Anyway, Thursday, Nancy comes in the shop. She's got this little blue book. She slaps it down on my station. She says, Al-Anon, next door, 12 o'clock. Now, she said she didn't say it like that, but Al-Anons never forget. And at noon, it just happened to be, I had a time, box time at noon, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting at Southtown, next door. And I can remember, I went in there, and, I don't remember a whole lot about that meeting, but I sat with my back to the door, and they had this thing on the wall, and it said, you can walk away from a lot of pain in 12 steps. I knew that to be true already. Nancy and all her friends and all those people had already instilled that in me. And the one thing I do remember, and it's really funny, I have two people here that lived in Wichita Falls during that time. And we've talked about a lot of people. But Richard was, Michelle is over here, and Ann's back there. And those two people, we kind of, our new years in this program. He was at my first meeting. And he was AA, but he went to some Al-Anon. And he said, this is the only thing I remember that was said in that meeting, other than keep coming back. Alcoholism is a disease, and it affects the whole family. And he said it is a monster that destroys lives and devours family. The monster, because that's what I thought he was in the garage. Connected that. And he said, you keep coming, you can get help here from that. And I got the hope of this program, that there was something maybe that might help me. And they told me to attend 6 meetings. Well, I went to a meeting every day. And then in Wichita Falls, they had meetings at noon and meetings at night, and I went all the time. Because when I would be in that meeting for 1 hour, I could be okay. And they were so nice to me. I'd start whining, singing the hymns. Hymns did this and hymns did that. And he made me sick. And some old timer would say, sick people, Mary, sick people. And I'd go home with my resentment. And, of course, I was the martyr. I did this and this and that. And after all of that, how could he do this to me? And they told me to get off the cross. Somebody else needed the wood. And I'm grateful for those hard-nosed old-timers that would not let me get away with my whining and my ball-bagging and my complaining. They would call me on it. And they told me, you can attend 6 meetings. If you don't like it, we'll refund your misery. And that's the way they were, And I got real involved in conferences. And my first sponsor was the Al-Anon chair for a little conference that we had there. So I got you know, we just get drug along. And I was real active because I could be okay when I was around y'all. I could just be okay. And y'all, you talked about stuff that, I don't know how you talked about it because, you know, I wouldn't talk about it, you know, about laying in the bed at night and he's gone wishing he would die. So all my problems would be solved. You know, I get the money, the house to be paid for, you know, all my problems would be solved. And he was my problem. You just get rid of him. And we went back together. You know, he was going to go to AA. I was going to go to Al-Anon. And the Bluebird of Happiness was going to take up residence in our house. That is not what happened. Early sobriety is hard. Early recovery for an Al-Anon is hard. It's hard to break the patterns. It's hard to put stuff back together. You've got the financials, you know, all the stuff that goes with that. We didn't have legal, thank goodness. But just the mess that him and I had created, you know, I have a part in that. There was so many things about Al-Anon. I loved it. I went to conferences. I don't know what happened to the lady that was the chairperson, but, you know, about the second year, she, I don't know, quit. And immediately I was the chair of this conference, and I've been in Al-Anon about 2 years. And, you know, I had to be up here, and I had to do the countdown, and, you know, I'd already done some work, and some stuff had been removed, and I found out that this was something that I could do. You know, was to speak, to be up here. And I started speaking. I've done that quite a bit. You know, my disease is what affected my children. Not his. You know, I'm the one that loaded them up in the car. When I knew whatever I was going to find, when I got whatever or wherever I was going, I subjected my children to that. Not him. You know, if I was going to catch him with another woman or I was going to, you know, whatever that I was going to find, they saw that. And if I'd have stayed home, that, you know, they wouldn't have seen that. It really affected my older son. We did separate. We got divorced. We had one of them messy divorces that you see in the rooms. He's already got his next ex. I've got my next ex. We're having a great time. And he stalked me. He threatened to kill me. It was what it was. And he moved to San Antonio, and my younger son decided to move with him. And they were down there, and he got a sponsor down there that he started working with. He did a fourth step, but he never did the fourth call. And I know that because he told me. You know? And 6 months after our divorce was final, we got divorced in May of 97. At that same time, I got a phone call one day at the salon, and the place that was the adoption agency where my daughter, where they kind of dealt with stuff at the home where I went, called and gave me the name and number of my daughter. And they said, if you give us permission, we have to have your permission. We'll call her back and give her yours. And I said, yes, I'd release the records. When she turned 18, I'd release the records. I went up there to Oklahoma City and signed whatever they had that if she ever looked for me, that my records were released. And so they could tell her some information. And she called me about 30 minutes later. And I talked to my daughter. I knew God could, would. But not for me. I know today God can and will. And, you know, that relationship didn't really just pan out like I wanted it to. But she had a great life. She has a great life. and we connect every once in a while. We hung out a little bit at first. Call him the VF, biological father. Didn't know him real well. When you're doing what you're doing, sometimes you don't know him too well. And and then everybody knew, you know, this secret that I hadn't really talked about. Everybody and their dogs knew all this stuff about, you know, my smutty details. How freeing is that? Oh my goodness, you know, and a lot of healing and recovery through that catalyst. But that's one of the things, the big miracles that happened. I asked for it at a ladies' retreat 1 month to the day that it happened. And all I said was, you know, because I had met someone that had met their birth mom. And all I prayed was, God, if it's your will, draw her to me. But that's all it takes in this program. My children, Siri's asking me what she can help me with. I need a lot of help. My younger son, I went to Crested Butte conferences. It's real funny that we were talking about that, which you've been. I went early on. I went 14 years, and my younger son, the first year, I went by myself and with some people. I knew the Al-Anon speaker, Mama Nell from Warrica, went, and we had a great time. And then I went back the next year with my new next ex, and my son went, my younger one, and he went to Alateen. I never went to Alateen in Wichita Falls, but he didn't miss not one thing they had there. That group, you know, really did change his perspective about his dad and a lot of things. What happened with Richard is 6 months after our divorce was final, he found out he had cancer, and he only lived 8 months. And, man, I spent a lot of money divorcing him. And he living in San Antonio, and his sister had brought him to Lawton, and he was in the hospital, and she was having really bad panic attacks. And so they asked me if I'd come and help take care of him. And I called my sponsor, and I said, I don't know if I can do this. I don't really know if I can do this. And she said, well, I said, I don't know that I want to. She said, that's all right, honey, just as long as you do it. And I went and helped take care of him. Now, he was on morphine. Man, if he was so nice and congenial. If I'd known morphine had done that to him, I'd have put it in his breakfast years ago. But by this time, you see, he had, he finally had real amends, is what I call it. You know, there's two sides to amends. There's doing them, and there's accepting them. And I could sit still with my mouth long enough to accept his amends, and they were heartfelt, and I knew it. I knew the difference because his behavior had changed. But I helped take care of him. And middle of the night, you know, and he's all, you know, woo, feeling really good. And he wants to dance. Well, we never did dance. You know, first date, he wouldn't dance. We'd go out and party, and he wouldn't dance till he got drunk, and then he'd do the alligator or something. I don't know. But he wouldn't let me dance without him. Now, in recovery, I have made up for that. Isn't that right, Michelle? We have danced she said, we danced. They had a dance at birthday night, and we danced. But he wanted to dance, and we danced. Like it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I danced with him, and we could dance. And you know why we could dance? Because I wasn't leading. We never could slow dance together because I always wanted to lead. You know, and it can't be two leaders in a dance. And I think about that word guidance. G-U-I, God, you, and I. We dance. Guidance. And with the guidance of this program, and the guidance of the sponsor that wants more for me than I want for myself, they do, you know, and she would strongly suggest had the same sponsor for 23 years. I had a sponsor for a short time, and I had another one for a short time, and then I got the one that I had for 23 years. And, man, I call her ball bagging, and she would, you know, I went through a period she wanted me to not date for a year. Well, I never done that. Getting into, looking for, being out of, you know, all of that, looking for him, the right him, just the right him was going to make me okay. She wanted me to go a year. And I remember calling her ball bagging about, it's going to be Valentine's, I'm not going to get flowers. She said, I want you to call the florist, I want you to order flowers. I want you to put I love you on the card and have them sent to you. And you get a card and you write in it and you put it in the mail with a stamp. So you will get it in the mail yourself. Called her about, you know, when shaving my legs because I didn't need to because I wasn't going to be with a man. She strongly suggested, I call it sentenced to me, shaving my legs every single day. Be careful what you ball bag about to your sponsor. You know, those type of things. And I tell you what that did for me is those type of things in this program. You know, it doesn't matter how we feel. You know, feelings are not going to get you there. And the only thing that's going to change how I feel, those crappy feelings, is action. Get up, make your bed. Get on your knees and pray. Drink the water. You know, I never have liked water, but I've managed to learn to like water and drink it. Read my meditation books. Pray and meditate. Work with others. Those are actions. And if I do those enough, out of that comes the changed feelings. How I think changes. I have to do that every day. What I did yesterday doesn't count for today. I have to redo it every day. Because my spiritual condition is contingent. My daily reprieve is contingent on my spiritual condition. Now, I was raised on the Big Book. West Texas Big Book Thumping Al-Anons. If you have never ran into one, you don't know what. Oh, man. Talk about some women. And I went to a couple of Big Book studies. Al-Anon Big Book study. And there's a bunch of Al-Anons, and they throw in a couple of double winners. They might throw in one just because it's not a double winner. But we do a retreat on a weekend, and we read the first 164 pages of the Big Book in a weekend. And we discuss it, and we talk about it, and we, you know, and it's really funny. Out of that has come, you know, I'm a wet blanket. How dare Bill call me a wet blanket? How about that frothy emotional appeal? With the snot and the, that's what I think about. Frothy emotional appeal. Did I do that? Oh my goodness. You know, that Big Book describes me in a lot of ways. But if I just change the drinking to thinking, it's me. Yeah, it's me. And there's so much in that. I have people say, oh, it's so hard to understand. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Upon awakening. When do you do it? Upon awakening. When we retire at night. When agitated or doubtful. When do I do that? It tells you exactly. Step by step by step. I've done a lot of four steps. And I've never used a blueprint of progress. I'm turning myself in again. I've used the Big Book every time. My sponsees, they do a four step out of the Big Book. You know, that's what I was taught. And I teach what I was taught. And I'm just a Big Book Central Texas. Big Book Thumping Al-Anon. I work in a treatment center today. I went to college in this program. I got an undergrad in social work, a master's in counseling. And I know, you know, early in Al-Anon, taking algebra and going to Al-Anon sure kept me from focusing on him. at algebra, but, you know, I have a master's degree. There's not anyone else in my family that has a master's degree. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and in 2008, I stepped out from behind the chair doing hair and went to work in a treatment center. Now, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to sit in an office to do private practice with my famous high heels. But God has a different idea. I still work there today, and I get to see it every day. I get to see the light come on. I get to see people change their lives. I also see people die. But I also get the alligators on the phone, because an Al-Anon is someone that goes to meetings and works the steps and has a sponsor and works with others. Those other people are alligators. They have the little ears and the big mouth. And they'll come in there, they'll come in my office, and they'll say, Rhonda, you need to talk to these people. We have an alligator on the phone. So, one more thing. I knew this conference was really going to be special. I've had some really special things happen. And I was so excited I couldn't sleep. I got 3 hours of sleep before I came. And I get on the plane, and, you know, I pray for that one person that's here, that one person. I've spoke a lot, and there's always that one person that comes up to me and says, I never heard a speaker talk about sexual abuse. That happened to me, and you're the first person I'm telling. I had, you know, so I pray for that person before I come and speak somewhere. And I don't always know who it is. And I'm on the plane, and I've never slept on a plane before, but I did, about 30 minutes. And we're beginning to land, and the lady next to me, you know, was gathering her stuff up, and you get everything situated because we're going down. And she asked me, she said, are you from Atlanta, or are you going to visit family or something? I said, no, I'm from Wichita Falls, Texas, and I'm speaking at a conference. And she said, what kind of conference are you speaking at? And I said, actually, it's an Alcoholics Anonymous conference, and I am the Al-Anon speaker, and Al-Anon is for friends and families of alcoholics. And this tear runs down her face. And she says, I think my fiance is an alcoholic, and I don't know what to do. I said, I know what you can do. You can go to Al-Anon. Well, can you tell me about that? I 12-stepped this lady on the plane as we're landing, going to Atlanta. And I thought, okay, God, I'm done here. I can party the rest of the time. I'm done. Because I've already helped somebody. I gave her my business card. I wrote out, because she couldn't spell it. She was Oriental, and she was from Fort Worth. And my son lives in Fort Worth. And I told her there's some great meetings in Fort Worth. And I said, you can look this up online, and they'll have where the meetings are in Fort Worth and everything. And so I wrote Al-Anon, A-L-Anon. You got to have the dash. And I debated whether to put my cell number on there. My cell number, I've had the same cell number. It's all over all these phone lists, all over. Why would I care? And I did. And I said, if you need to talk, here's my card. And she took it and put it in her little thing she had. She was all organized. She's one of us. You know, the color-coded tabs and all the... anyway. But not only that, you know, that happened. I had a absolutely wonderful time with Jill. Went to her house. We walked downtown. We shared. It was just absolutely wonderful. And then last night with Michelle, and her telling me about the influence in her life that I had on her. You don't know. You just don't know. And that was 20 years ago. And then Anne, and us talking about the crazy stuff we did early on recovery. We're nuts. You know, not using the steps. That's what that stands for. Nuts. I love the slogans that aren't slogans in this program. And one of my favorite ones is, her name was Miss Jane. these people are not here anymore, Miss Jane. She would say, they can't get you goat if they don't know where it's tied up. You know, and that's that thing about, you know, that it's about them. It's not about me. And another lady would say, well, what are you doing with buttons? Because I'd say, they push my buttons. What are you doing with buttons? I told them I just wanted to get my ducks in a row, and they said, they're not your ducks. I love this program. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, God knew I was going to be a hard case, so he sent a whole AA club. And then he sent Nancy and the people since then. And Jan, my sponsor. I lost Jan last year. She got dementia. And dementia is very sad because you lose them twice. And my mom has dementia. And I go and see her, and the same thing happened. I took Jan to the last place where I spoke, and I was talking about her sponsoring me. She says, I never sponsored you. I said, Jan, you've been my sponsor 23 years. And she started crying, and she said, I don't remember. And I said, it doesn't matter. I remember. And that's what I know with my mom. I go see my mom. I could go in the morning, turn around and go in the afternoon, and she'd say, oh, it's just been so long since I've seen you. Because she doesn't remember. But I remember. And that's what this program teaches me. It's about what I do. It's about my behavior. Doesn't matter how you act. You can be all greedy. I don't have to be greedy. You know, you can be rude. I don't have to be rude. It's about what I do. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm just so appreciative of this conference. It's like a shot in the arm for me, I tell you. And all you people in recovery, you're still the laughingest, huggingest bunch of people. And I absolutely love it. And I love every single one of you. Thank you for your time.